The Week in Philly on KYW News Radio is recorded and edited every Friday afternoon. For the latest updates to any of the stories you're about to hear, listen to KYW News Radio anytime on your smart speaker or the Odyssey or iHeartRadio apps. Visit KYWNewsRadio.com or follow us on social media at KYW News Radio.
This is The Week in Philly from KYW News Radio. Sponsored by your Delaware Valley Honda dealers. Get a deal you'll like on a Honda you'll love.
Welcome to a special edition of The Week in Philly. In honor of America's birthday, we are going to spend the next hour bringing in KYW News Radio reporters to take a look at some of the figures that have helped shape the last 250 years of Philadelphia history. Sabrina Boyd Circa will tell us about William Still, referred to as the father of the Underground Railroad.
He was the guy that people knew to go to when they arrived in Philly on their path to freedom.
Then Mike DiNardo will tell us the fascinating story of Sadie T.M. Alexander.
She became the first black woman admitted to Penn Law.
Carol McKenzie will be here to talk about the man behind Bartram's Garden.
He initially laid out his garden across 6 or 7 acres.
Then Pat Loeb tells us about two of the enslaved people who toiled at the president's house under George Washington, but eventually found freedom.
He was the first White House chef.
Then we learn about the family behind the legendary Philadelphia ice cream brand, Bassett's.
The sixth generation within the Bassett family to be leading this company.
Brian Seltzer will have that story. And then John McDevitt tells us about the woman behind the iconic tavern, McGillin's Old Ale House.
She was an extremely strong woman and maintained order in both business and in the family.
All that is ahead over the next hour. I hope you'll join us for this special edition of The Week in Philly from KYW News Radio, and we will get started right after this. This is The Week in Philly, and this weekend we are celebrating, of course, the 250th birthday of the United States of America. Of course, Philadelphia is where it all began back in 1776 with the signing of the Declaration of Independence. And for the last several weeks on KYW News Radio, we have been running pieces focusing on some of the important people from Philadelphia who have helped shape history over the last 2.5 centuries. And on this special edition of The Week in Philly, we wanted to focus on some of our favorite 250 years of Philly voices subjects. And we start with the man called the father of the Underground Railroad. And for more, let's bring in KYW's Sabrina Boyd Circa. And Sabrina, who was William Still?
So William Still was one of the best known at the time leaders of the abolitionist movement in Philadelphia. He was born a free black man in 1821, New Jersey. He moved to Philly to work as a janitor and a clerk for the Anti-Slavery Society, starting as a janitor. And he worked his way up to the point where he was the guy that people knew to go to when they arrived in Philly on their path to freedom. Even Harriet Tubman knew William Still is the guy you got to see.
And this kind of leads into how he got the moniker, the father of the Underground Railroad, I would imagine, right?
Yeah. So he was the chair of the Vigilance Committee, which means he was in charge of documenting all the people who passed through. He would do a little intake interview with them, hear their stories, and write it down. And after the Civil War in 1872, he published all of those records and called it the Underground Railroad. So hence, the father of the Underground Railroad. Now, this is really some of the only documentation that we have of these people's stories. So otherwise, we wouldn't know anything about them. They wouldn't have been able to find their families. You know, often families weren't able to travel together. And William Still did all of that.
And this is obviously very important work. But I have to imagine, given that we fought a civil war over this, this was incredibly risky for him, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, at the time, it was illegal to help people who were trying to escape slavery. We had the Fugitive Slave Act. There were bounty hunters trying to recapture slaves. People who were found to be helping freedom seekers would face riots. Businesses were burned down. And Jeanine Cook, who's the owner of Harriet's Bookshop, of course, named after Harriet Tubman, just kind of knows everything about this kind of history. She put it really well.
If you're on the way out, if you're escaping, people know to come to William Still because he's keeping records like nobody's business, records that would have gotten him probably locked up, if not killed. Because if you think about it, if you are somewhere and you leave, like, how are you going to find your friends and family? Like, how? we needed people like William Still, who was willing to risk his own freedom so that other people could be reunited with their families.
And there's also a fascinating personal story in all this. Still found his own brother doing all this with the Underground Railroad. How'd that happen?
Yeah, so his family story is really interesting. I talked to Cindy Malak from the Harriet Tubman Museum of New Jersey. She told me that William Still was born free man in New Jersey, but his parents were enslaved.
They came to New Jersey to find freedom. His father purchased his own freedom and his mother escaped.
Now, Still was the youngest of 18 siblings, so very long family history there. Four of them were born into slavery with his parents. And when his mother was escaping, she was only able to bring two of the four. So she had to make a really, really tough decision. She brought her two daughters and left the two sons.
All of this is very close to the heart of William Still growing up, knowing that his siblings were somewhere enslaved and he didn't know them, never got a chance to meet them.
Many, many years later, William Still, who has never met this brother, is doing his intakes as people are coming through Philadelphia on the Underground Railroad. And he hears a guy talking about his parents, whose father bought his freedom, his mother escaped, but wasn't able to take all of her children.
So as William Still is listening to this, he recognizes that this is his story. This is the story of his family and that he's meeting his brother for the first time. So he's able to reintroduce his brother to his mother and to his family.
He met his brother for the first time by doing this work, by finding all the backstories of people who were just trying to get their freedom.
All right. Thank you very much, Sabrina. That's KYW's Sabrina Boyd Circuit joining us. And we are just getting started on this special edition of The Week in Philly. We will have more for you right after this. Don't go anywhere.
She was a woman of many firsts, and she really didn't let much stand in her way at all. And I think that that is a lesson that we want to teach our children.
Welcome back to this special 250 Years of Philly Voices edition of The Week in Philly. And now we are going to learn the fascinating story of Sadie T.M. Alexander. And for more, let's bring in KYW's Mike DiNardo. Mike, this really was an incredible woman. Who was she?
Sadie Tanner Mossel Alexander in 1921 became one of the first three black women in America to earn a PhD, but there's much more to her story. She came from a family of legal trailblazers. Her father, Aaron Mossel, was the first African American to graduate from Penn Law. Her uncle, Nathan Francis Mossel, was the first African American to graduate from Penn's medical school. Sadie's undergrad studies at the University of Pennsylvania were at the School of Education. Along the way, she became the first national president of the Delta Sigma Theta sorority. Then she went on to graduate school at Penn and earned her doctorate in economics. Again, one of the first black women to earn a PhD.
But despite that accomplishment, she couldn't find a job?
Yeah, that's right. It was a different time back then. Racism and sexism were much more prevalent. White women were beginning to be more accepted in the workplace, but being a black woman, Alexander couldn't find a job in Philadelphia. So she went to Durham, North Carolina to work for 2 years at a black-owned company, the North Carolina Mutual Life Insurance Company. She married attorney Raymond Pace Alexander in 1923 and then returned to Philadelphia.
And that eventually led to another first for her, right?
Yeah, she became the first black woman admitted to Penn Law and was the first African-American woman to serve as associate editor of Penn's Law Review. She graduated in 1927, the first to be admitted to the bar in Pennsylvania. So she worked at her husband's law firm, practicing family and estate law, focusing on the civil rights of African Americans, battling segregation, discrimination in employment, and discrimination in housing.
Where'd her life take her after that?
She became a human rights activist while she practiced law. She formed a bureau to help African Americans who couldn't afford lawyers. In 1927, she became an assistant city solicitor for the city of Philadelphia, the first African American woman in that position, and she was appointed to the City Human Relations Commission. Alexander also served on President Truman's Committee on Human Rights in 1947. She served another president, President than Jimmy Carter. He appointed her chair of the White House Conference on Aging in 1978. Alexander also served on the board of the National Urban League for 25 years. She continued to be active in the legal community until her retirement in 1982. She died in 1989 at the age of 91. And Matt, the city is in the process of commissioning a statue of Alexander to be placed outside the Municipal Services Building.
Another way her legacy lives on is there is a school named after her, and they really celebrate her legacy, right?
Absolutely. It is what is commonly called the Penn Alexander School. It's a K-8 school in West Philadelphia, established 25 years ago, officially called the Sadie T.M. Alexander UPenn Partnership School, but we always shorten it to Penn Alexander. The University of Pennsylvania provides money and educational resources to the school, and the students there make sure to celebrate Alexander's birthday each year on January 2nd, says Principal Lauren Overton.
By celebrating her birthday, we also have activities throughout the school community, really helping the students understand who she was, you know, her basic biography of her life, and all of the amazing achievements that she accomplished.
Students created a portrait of Alexander, which hangs in the school's atrium, and Overton says Alexander's influence extends into the classroom.
We've even had certain years where for Black History Month, we celebrated different portions of her lifetime. And I think it's deeply related to the idea of our core values.
There is a quote from Alexander that reads, "I knew well that the only way I could get that door open was to knock it down, because I knocked all of them down. Don't let anything stop you." Overton told us that Alexander didn't let much stand in her way at all, and that that is an important lesson for the students at the Philadelphia school that bears her name.
One of the things, as I've kind of gone through these pieces to help put this show together, she's really one of the people that I'm just stunned I hadn't learned more about. I mean, you talk about a career without even putting the idea of being a trailblazer, just the accomplishments themselves. And then you put the trailblazing part on top. It's really something.
When the bosses here said to us to come up with people we should recognize during this series, I did think of Alexander, because even though her name was on a school, I didn't know completely about her legacy, and dived in and found that she is just a fascinating person. And again, the city is making a point to put up a statue of her outside the Municipal Services Building so that many more people would learn about her life.
All right. Thank you very much, Mike. That's KYW's Mike DiNardo joining us. We need to step away. We will continue on this special edition of The Week in Philly right after this. It's The Week in Philly, sponsored by your Delaware Valley Honda dealers. Get a deal you'll like on a Honda you'll love.
These expeditions took him to places where he was able to find plants that folks hadn't even interacted with before.
Welcome back to this special edition of The Week in Philly, as we feature some of our favorite subjects from our 250 Years of Voices series. Now we would like to focus on a man who helped create America's first botanical garden. And for more on this, let's bring in KYW's Carol McKenzie. And Carol, who was John Bartram of Bartram's Gardens fame?
He was really a self-taught naturalist. What he did was pretty incredible. He bought 100 acres of farmland along the Schuylkill in Kingsessing, which is in southwest Philadelphia. He did this in 1728. He eventually expanded to, I think, about 400 acres. But the garden now is about 60 acres of that. But when he first started, he initially laid out his garden across 6 or 7 acres. The house he built, which took him 40 years to build there, was facing the river. So when you first pull into Bartram Garden, you're actually looking at the back of his house. If you go around to the front of it, you will see the terraced gardens where they think he first began. The reason the house is facing the river is because people from Center City didn't come by road. They came by the river, so they would have come down and the house would have been facing them and they would have been walking to the front of the house. He had a real interest. He traveled all the way from Nova Scotia down to Florida collecting plant specimens and seeds, and he propagated these plants on his property and really had a booming seed business and a plant business. People from all over really became interested in these plants he was growing.
And you mentioned self-taught. So this was just a passion? This was really at the heart of this was just a love of gardening and plants and such?
Yeah, he just really had a love of nature, and he was curious about plants. He was also an artist. His drawings, apparently, I haven't seen them, but his drawings were very specific. He would draw the plants. He created basically a library of plants that had never been seen before. So he really not only cultivated this garden, but he really cultivated this kind of business that we see today where people will propagate plants and seeds. He was the father, really, of this type of botanic gardening.
Was his goal to create something for the public, or did it kind of, as far as we can tell, kind of morph into this bigger cause here? Like, did he just have a passion for it and enjoyed being in the backyard at first, like I do, and it eventually became Bartram's Gardens? Like, do we kind of know what the timeline looked like?
Not totally. They know that they bought the land, first started out with 100 acres in 1728. And he did start his first garden there. And I think it just kind of organically, if you will, organically grew from there. And then as he traveled, like I said, all up and down the East Coast, collecting plant samples, he was talking with indigenous people, learning from them, learning what they had grown and what worked with the land. So I think it was this thing that just started out of his curiosity and his desire to have a property like this. I mean, you think about it, he had greenhouses, he had seed categories, and this garden was carried forth by his descendants, his two sons, and then eventually his granddaughter. They had all different kinds of plants. They had a garden out front where I think they had mostly flowers and stuff like that that they were interested in. So I really think this idea that he had grew from his curiosity about plants themselves, and it went from there.
You mentioned 40 years to build the house. How long did the Bartram family run the garden?
They ran it until 1850. His granddaughter, Anne Bartram Carr, was the last descendant to have the garden. She sold it in 1850. In 1891, the city of Philadelphia designated it as a public park. And then in 1960, it was recognized as a national historic landmark by the Department of Interior.
You took a ride out to Bartram Gardens and talked to people. Like, what did you see? What was it like? What'd you learn?
I was stunned. It's so beautiful. I'm embarrassed to say I've heard of it, but I just never made it there to see it. I would highly recommend going. You don't have to be super into plants or botany to enjoy it. It's just absolutely beautiful. I had a small tour with executive director Maitre Roy, and she told me she thinks this was the first plant enterprise like this in the country.
Documents show that he had about 10 greenhouses here where he was collecting plants and then growing them. And soon enough, there were people from across the oceans who were interested in getting plants from him.
So as she said, it was a first of its kind. And then people really started coming from everywhere to see the plants, to buy the plants, to buy the seeds. And as she mentioned, people from Europe became interested in what he was selling.
All right. Thank you very much, Carol. That's KYW's Carol McKenzie joining us. We need to take a break. We will have more of this special edition of The Week in Philly right after this.
When you talk about American history, like talking about anything else, you must tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. Otherwise, it's a bunch of lies.
We continue on this special 250 years of Philly Voices edition of The Week in Philly. That was Michael Cord, a founding member of Avenging the Ancestors Coalition, speaking recently about the fate of the display at the President's House on Independence Mall. Now, it's been at the center of controversy for a while now as the Trump administration has tried to sanitize the history being told of slavery at the site under our first president, George Washington. But as our second president, John Adams said, facts are stubborn things. There were slaves toiling at the house. And to learn more about some of these figures, let's bring in KYW City Hall Bureau Chief Pat Loeb. And Pat, you focused on two of the enslaved who spent time at the president's house, Hercules Posey and Ona Judge. Let's start with Hercules Posey. Who was he?
He was the first White House chef. And of course, that job has come to be very esteemed. And he set the tone. He made gourmet meals for visiting dignitaries. He learned international cuisine and sourced the finest ingredients himself. He did the shopping, bickered and bargained with vendors. Accounts of the time describe him as rather foppish, cutting a striking figure. And he was well known in Philadelphia. And another thing that set him apart was that he had a source of income. He would sell leftovers from the president's house kitchen, you know, unused fat and that sort of thing. And that's how he afforded his fine clothes.
But despite this culinary talent, he was a slave. And while he was well known here in Philadelphia, eventually George Washington sent him back to his home in Mount Vernon, correct?
Yes, because Pennsylvania was a free state, and any slaves brought in from elsewhere would have to be freed within 6 months. Washington wanted his slaves with him, but he had to play games to keep them here without freeing them. And he used to rotate them in and out, and he was convinced that Hercules would take advantage of the situation and escape. So he sent this internationally renowned chef back to work in the fields.
Did he ever escape?
He did indeed. He took advantage of a big celebration in Philadelphia for Washington's birthday and snuck out of the Virginia plantation, never to be seen again, though some fairly recent research suggests that he died in New York City, a free man, in 1812.
Now let's focus on Ona Judge. What was her story?
Ona was just a teenager when she was brought to Philadelphia, but she heard about that 6 months to freedom rule and she started plotting right away. But the Washingtons had that rotation system going and Ona was restricted because she was Martha Washington's personal attendant. So she was very close to the First Lady all the time.
Now she was able to escape though and earn freedom, right?
Yes. Well, Martha Washington told Ona, or Ona overheard, that she was planning to give Ona to her granddaughter as a wedding present, which would mean back to Virginia and losing the chance that Philadelphia offered. So she just ran one night while the family was eating dinner, and she was able to get to New Hampshire. But the Washingtons tried to get her back. They took out newspaper ads and offered a reward to anyone that would return her. Washington even sent the Secretary of the Treasury to negotiate with New Hampshire officials for her return, but she lived free in New Hampshire until her death.
And it's interesting, her memory was recently honored by the city here, right?
Yes, City Council passed a resolution declaring Ona Judge Day, and that is on May 21st.
All right, thank you very much, Pat. That's KYW City Hall Bureau Chief Pat Loeb joining us. We need to take a break. We will have much more of this special edition of The Week in Philly coming your way right after this.
We've maintained our recipe for over 100 years. It's pretty interesting to think, what would it have been like to eat ice cream at this very counter 130 years ago?
This is a special 250 years of Philly Voices edition of The Week in Philly. And when it comes to food history in the U.S., specifically Philadelphia, ice cream plays a big role. And there is a brand that is truly synonymous with Philadelphia. And for more, let's bring in our own Brian Seltzer. And Brian, Bassett's Ice Cream is a Philadelphia staple. And before we talk about them specifically, though, give us some context with just how much the history of ice cream really is wrapped up with the city of Philadelphia.
Yeah, Matt, and think about how to tell Philadelphia's ice cream story. There were a couple different places to possibly start from. Breyers, of course, founded in Philadelphia in Southwest Philly. One of the original factories was there. They've since moved on. The first ever patented hand-cranked ice cream freezer created in Philadelphia by a woman named Nancy M. Johnson in the 1840s. But right, when you think about Philadelphia ice cream, it's that blue gold trim white logo at Reading Terminal Market on the 12th Street side. Bassett's Ice Cream, it's been around. It has its roots going back to 1861. So yes, that felt like the appropriate starting place to tell Philadelphia's ice cream story.
So give us the origin story of Bassett's.
So not too far from Matt Leon's backyard, Salem, New Jersey, is where old Louis Bassett had a mule churn in his backyard, and that was cranking out the first ice cream that Bassett dabbled with. And he was a Quaker school teacher at the time, but he kept working at this ice cream thing. And by the mid-1880s, he had perfected the craft enough and had enough financial wherewithal to open up the first Bassett's ice cream stand on Fifth and Market.
So when does the business really hit its stride?
So as we all know, Bassett's at this point in time, it's the stand in Reading Terminal Market. RTM opens in 1892. Bassett's was the first merchant tenant to sign a lease of any kind in Reading Terminal Market. And it's the last original merchant that's still there to this day. And when I went to Bassett's to visit with its current president, Alex Bassett Strange, a few weeks ago, you go there and it just feels like such a nostalgic spot.
Our marble countertop has been here from the very beginning.
Alex was showing me how you can still see scars in the marble countertop from the days when, you know, the parlor servers would slide the dishes of ice cream across the countertop.
You can feel on this original marble countertop some of the wear and tear that sliding all of those dishes for so many years has left behind. If this countertop could talk, it would have quite the number of stories.
What has been the key to longevity for the business and the Bassett family?
The coolest thing about this story to me, Matt, without question, is that right now, Alex Strange, he is the sixth generation within the Bassett family to be leading this company, and they've been able to keep it internal and within the family. Alex joined the company a decade ago. He had dabbled in some other parts of the food and hospitality industry, but he wanted to be part of the family business. And when he told me the story about when he sat down with his uncle and his grandmother, it kind of was crystal clear to him just how significant a mantle this would be to carry the family business forward.
When I expressed interest in joining the business, my uncle and my grandmother took me out to dinner, and we talked about the history of the business, the gravity of undertaking a role like running America's oldest ice cream company. And the mandate was, don't let it end with you. That's why we pay very close attention to maintaining my great-grandfather's recipe, a superior level of service, and also understanding the business side of it so that we can stay around for another six generations.
Clearly, when you're given an ultimatum like that, this is something to take seriously. And the big thing, it's not just for Bassett's, but any company business where it's got this original family feel, is like, how do you balance the old and the original with the new and continuing to evolve? For starters, Alex said, you don't mess with a tried and true recipe.
It's my great-grandfather's recipe. And we make a 16.5% milk fat, super premium, Philadelphia style ice cream. Now, people ask, you know, what's Philadelphia style? That means that we don't use any egg yolk in our ice cream. So you've got a really dairy forward flavor profile. Still got that full fat, creamy, silky, smooth mouthfeel, but it's not that heavy custard like experience that you might get with another brand.
As far as how the company's expanded over the years, they've added some vegan flavors that you can get at the ice cream stand in Reading Terminal Market. They have sorbets. The big thing I didn't know was they actually have a really strong business overseas in China and South Korea. There are retail stands there. They also do some distribution. But Alex, when I asked him about the footprint regionally and within the United States, he seemed very content to have the store in Reading Terminal Market be the flagship. Most of the distribution takes place within like a 45-mile radius within Center City. And he's like, listen, it's a competitive space, ice cream. Just think about your grocer's freezer. They're fine to keep their bread and butter, so to speak, with the main stand.
Do you have a favorite flavor?
The 40 flavors on the menu at the Reading Terminal Market stand, I am partial, Matt, to birthday cake, peanut butter swirl, but this listen, it is semi-quincentennial season, right? So for the season, they have a special red, white, and blueberry to celebrate, and that takes their classic Madagascar bourbon vanilla ice cream swirled generously, Alex said, with blueberry and raspberry sauces. So great to see that an institution in Philadelphia, Bassett's ice cream, getting the spirit of the semi-quincentennial.
My favorite ice cream history story is that Dolly Madison's favorite ice cream, which she would serve, was oyster ice cream. Upon further research, it sounds like that is not true and people can't figure out where that came from. But I'm trying to get my head around oyster, which I'm guessing is not on the Bassett's menu.
Well, now that we're going to have this 200 years of Philly Voices project cleared out of the way, we can all start a mass newsroom effort to investigate the truth behind that story.
We will look into it. Thank you very much, Brian. That's KYW's Brian Seltzer joining us. We need to step away. We will have more of this special edition of The Week in Philly coming up. Don't go anywhere.
Catherine McGillan was everybody's mom. And on her last birthday of 89, over 4,000 people came to wish her a happy birthday.
Final segment for this special edition of The Week in Philly as we continue to focus on some iconic people and personalities in Philadelphia history. This as we celebrate the 250th birthday of the U.S. this weekend. McGillan's Old Ale House on Drury Street in Center City. It's an iconic tavern. In fact, it is the oldest continually operating tavern in Philadelphia. And now let's learn about the woman who got it started by bringing in KYW's John McDevitt. John, who was Catherine Ma McGillan?
Hi, Matt. Catherine McGillan and her husband were Irish immigrants. They opened the Bell and Hand Tavern in 1860. They served food, they had beer taps, and raised 13 children on the upper floor above the tavern. Catherine was known to all as Ma and her husband William Pa. In 1913, when Pa died, Ma took over the business and renamed it to McGillan's Old Ale House in honor of her husband.
Now, I know you talked to the current owner. How does he describe her?
Yeah, current co-owner Christopher Mullins Jr. says Ma was one of a kind. He says she was an extremely strong woman and maintained order in both business and in the family.
She worked hard from the moment the bar opened till the moment the tavern closed and then had a return to her family. So it was a lot. I think people far and wide came to respect her for her openness and warm hospitality, but at the same time to follow her rules. And she left her impact for all of us that have come after.
That run she had where she's running it, that spans Prohibition. How did she handle Prohibition at McGillan's? Because that everybody had to pivot at that point.
Sure. So in 1920 to 1933, during Prohibition, Ma was able to keep money flowing by renting out space to a dairy and pivoting to food service. And it's alleged, Matt, that there was a speakeasy operating upstairs serving booze in teacups.
The question still remains, was the second floor operating as a speakeasy, which many people believe today. So she managed. Nothing ever held her back. She was persistent and wise and was well loved because of it.
And I know also from talking to you, there's lore that Ma is still in a way with us, right?
Yeah. There's Ma sightings at the tavern. There's an image of her that people allege is her in a mirror. There were ghost hunting adventures there. And many people do think that Ma comes back and they hear noises in the kitchen, which is in the basement. And everybody, at least they would like to think that dear old Ma is watching over them.
All right. Thank you very much, John. That's KYW's John McDevitt. And that is going to do it for this special 4th of July weekend edition of The Week in Philly from KYW News Radio, sponsored by your Delaware Valley Honda dealers. Get a deal you like on a Honda you'll love. This week's episode was produced by Sabrina Boyd-Circa and Brian Seltzer. My name is Matt Leon. Thanks so much for listening and enjoy the rest of your holiday weekend.